Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome you to Porch Talk. This is your host, Alan. I have Johnny Havard and Justin Howard with me. And I can't wait because this is going to wrap up the Labor Day weekend in Mobile, Alabama. So here is I Can't Wait by Starry Micey.
I had you on the telephone, said you won't be coming home. Heard you had to leave the state, said you won't be back someday. Well, now I can't wait. No, I think you should stay.
Just a little bit about y'all getting to know each other and becoming friends, and then we'll just roll right into it.
Well, the saga begins a long time ago in a trailer park far, far away. No, what a trailer park. It was a trailer, though. Well, it was even before that. Me and Howard have known each other for,
I think it's about a little over 10 years.
Over 10 years now. If you know, not counting the times that I knew him when I was a kid, because he was really good friends with my older cousin, and so, you know, and he lived with my cousin lived with our great grandmother, and they lived right next door to us, and there weren't a whole lot of kids in our neighborhood besides me and my brother, and so I was like, I'm gonna hang out with him, you know. And Anthony had a Nintendo and he had a computer and he had all this shit, and mm-hmm. I was like, I don't got nothing. So, hanging out with them, and then I started hanging out with his friends, because they would all come over to Nanny's and hang out, and that's when I started meet him and some other friends. Well, flash forward, I graduated high school. My dad just passed. I'm out partying, doing shit, wanting to get into shit, and I started hanging out with my older cousin again, which probably shouldn't have did, but in hindsight, I'm glad I did, because I started hanging out, and then I started hanging out with this guy again, and becoming better friends, and then later on, the guy's house we were hanging out with, we pretty much banished my cousin from the circle, because he was just... He's a shithead.
Too much.
That's too much. Like we could do probably a whole separate podcast of just about what that dude did. But
let's give the kids bad ideas.
Yeah, don't give. No. You can learn a thing or two. If anything, learn not what to do.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but later on, I wound up living when I started working at the prison. I started living with a mutual friend of ours, Tim. And we were hanging out. We were always hanging out. We always had people over. And then this guy showed up. And then I was, like, just getting to talk to him and everything. I'm like, this dude is fucking awesome. Like, he's just so smart. And I'm just like, I can learn something from this dude. And we just started hanging out more. And then we just started hanging out regularly. And then, he's the one that introduced me to stand-up. Introduced me to Bill Hicks, Rogan, Chappelle, you know, all those guys. And then we talk about film and movies and everything. So he's been a big, huge inspiration to who I am now. So I call him my older brother. So
yeah. Yeah, I'm touched, sir.
And just with that, man, just when I added you on Facebook and getting to see some of the film work that you've done and, like, just some of the posts, is strong opinions and a lot of humor. It's funny. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah. Me and another mutual friend of ours, Brett Nelson. We all started hanging out together too. We were at a party. We were at my cousin's house, and we all wound up watching King of the Hill together. And then we were like, all right, we're gonna start hanging out with these. So we all just started hanging out. We still got a group text message, like the three of us from fucking years and years, just random stuff, random memes and whatnot.
Uh huh.
So, I learned a lot from both of them too, it's crazy. I
guess, let's start a little bit on comedy, man. So Justin, how'd you get into it? How'd you find it? And, like, just as far as, like, the influence of Bill Hicks and, some of those cats.
As far as comedy, Johnny and I probably have this in common. I mean, as a child, I think the first comedy that really made me lose my shit was Jim Carrey movies. That early run, Ace Ventura, Dumb and Dumber, Liar Liar,
The Mask,
And I mean, that was sort of the groundwork for okay, this is what's really funny. This is what's great comedy. At the time in my young adolescent mind, whatever. And not really a lot of stand up. I mean, obviously, living in the South, Jeff Foxworthy was
the very first comedy show ubiquitous
presence. You couldn't get away from him. Yeah. And so, all the whole, you might be a redneck if, XYZ. Yeah. As a kid, I found that funny. But as far as stand-up, I really didn't delve heavily into stand-up until I got into college. And the first stand-up comedian that just really, as an adult, just really made me lose my shit was Lewis Black.
Okay.
Which, actually, going back a little bit earlier, I was a huge fan of The Daily Show starting in middle school, even to the point where he always did segments. I mean, I even started watching in the pre-Jon Stewart era, which most people probably don't know existed, but Craig Kilborn, he was the original host before Jon Stewart.
I forgot about that.
Yeah, I mean, before Jon Stewart took that and made it the cultural behemoth that it is today. Yeah, I mean, I was watching then, and Lewis Black, he was on there as a correspondent from the beginning, doing his Back in Black segment. So, like, it's like, 11, 12 years old, I'm just watching this really angry Jew who hates everything.
You just described his whole career. This is his whole career.
I have a fondness for angry Jews who hate everything and are funny as hell. I mean, I mean, you know, like Larry David is my totem.
Yeah,
I defer to that guy always.
I want to say, like, some of my first, maybe the first film I saw Lewis Black in was that. Do y'all remember Justin Long Was Accepted?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was. It was really good.
Yeah.
And Lewis's Black character, it was just hilarious.
Yeah, was he like the dean?
They hired him.
Yeah, they hired him to be the dean.
Yeah.
One of my favorite parts of that movie is like they were kind of doing the montage of like how the school's growing, and then it just shows Lewis Black. He's in the middle, and he's just ranting, and he's just going on about how to be successful.
Being an angry Jew.
Being an angry Jew. And there's just like hundreds of people around him, and he's just getting into it, and then they're all cheering, and he's like... You know,
I
think that was the first thing I ever saw him in, honestly, because I didn't really watch any of his stand up or anything. I didn't really get into watching stand up comedy until really after I started hanging out with this dude. Because, like he said, growing up, the only comics or comedy that we knew of was the blue collar guys.
Yeah, man.
But I mean, I got nothing against them personally. It was just that thing that.
I love Ron White.
If there's any of them that I've taken anything from,
he is one of my favorites.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, when I was a kid, he was my least favorite. I guess it's because I wasn't old enough to enjoy it.
Because
you know, it was like you might be a redneck with Foxworthy, and then what was it? Here's Your Son.
Yeah, Bill Engvall. Yeah. See, and that was the thing. They kind of had their shticks. That's kind of what they went for as far as their style of comedy. And then with Ron White, too, what stuck with him was the tater salad thing. And that was actually the name of one of his specials.
Yeah, I mean,
that was
one special, and that was just one bit from that special.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, that wasn't a thing that he just kept, you know, doing
right.
and doing.
But that was the thing that they labeled him. Yeah, but that's what
they
labeled
call
him.
Me tater salad.
Because it's like everybody that was in that blue-collar group. Yeah. It's like they had to be identified by, like, a certain thing.
Right. And then, of course, Larry the Cable Guy, Get Her Done and everything. Mm-hmm. So, but yeah, that was...
You mean Dan Whitney?
I didn't think that was ever going to leave. I remember being in high school and that blowing up, and then it was...
Oh, they sold millions and millions of albums.
Stickers on the back of windshields and...
Yeah. They had a TV show, Comedy Central.
Because in the mid-2000s, like, the two big forces in comedy were basically, unless my bearing is off, unless my memory fails me, it was... Blue collar comedy and Dane Cook.
Yeah. Yeah.
Dane Cook. Got outed, man. I miss his stuff, though.
He's trying to make a comeback, but he's kind of fell into same thing that kind of Schumer's going through with the joke theft and whatnot. That was handled differently, but also a lot of people didn't like his persona, like the, you know, like how he. All put himself out there like the kind of guy he was, and he did. He got crazy popular because I remember the same thing like he said, because that's what sticks out in my mind thinking back then, is him and when he did his Vicious Circle special, and then all the movies he was in. He was in a bunch of rom coms.
Yeah, and he was
stuff.
Always the same guy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, pretty much. Yeah,
Good Luck Chuck and all that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
And see, at that time, like whenever mid-2000s, at the height of his popularity, like I said, that was around the time when I really started, as an adult, getting into serious stand-up comedy. So I'm listening to Lewis Black, I'm listening to Dave Chappelle, George Carlin, you know, Bill Hicks, all around that time, I'm taking in all these, you know, massive influences.
Yeah.
Some of the greatest comedians that have ever lived.
And you passed that
and
on
it's
to
like,
me,
because you know,
I was ignorant.
So, like, I'm looking at what I'm getting into and what I'm getting out of it. Uh-huh. And, like, I'm, you know... comparing it to what's popular at the time, Dane Cook and fucking Larry the Cable Guy.
Yeah.
And I'm like, these people are the antichrist of comedy. I want nothing to do with them.
Yeah.
I'm like, this is the dumbing down of America. They are here to destroy our civilization. They're here to destroy comedy. We need to stop them at all costs. I mean, now, my feelings have mellowed.
Yeah.
Back then, everything was us or them, you know.
Well, it just goes to show you, they were promoting what they knew was making money.
Mm-hmm.
But you still had comics at the time, too. That were still extremely successful, just they were kind of shadowed in because they were selling out arenas, they were selling millions and millions of copies of albums and DVDs and everything, and then the money, and then the movies and stuff, it just kind of got overshadowed. They kind of overshadowed everybody else at the comedy store or who else has been doing stand-up. Mm-hmm. And then after that died down, these other guys have been coming, you know, making their way back out. So...
Yeah, I remember, it's kind of like what y'all were talking about with like growing up and having this, you know, this group of friends. I remember the first time that I finally saw Dave Chappelle show.
Oh, really?
And overall, it was a star group, and it was like the first night I'd ever seen this, and I was like, sketch comedy might be the greatest thing in the world. Mm-hmm. And he's the king of it. Because Key and Peele, right when he stepped out, they stepped in, and I was like, this is just not as good.
Yeah.
Both of them very talented, but I just don't like it as much.
Well, see, they came from the Mad TV days also, didn't they?
Yeah.
Yeah. So they were familiar with it, but then it was just now they had the opportunity to just do their own thing.
And the way that Mad TV was the lesser version of SNL, Key and Peele was the lesser version of Chappelle's show.
Yeah.
I hate saying that. I love those guys, but... I
mean, yeah, yeah.
That literally, Chappelle's show is the single greatest sketch comedy show of all time.
Right.
I mean, when you look at just... I mean, it was only two seasons.
Yeah.
And look at the impact that it has. How many people still quote that show? I still quote that show, like, on a daily basis.
And it's not even
sketch,
a cult.
Whatever.
Yeah, it's not even a cult following. It's like, cult following is still, like, a small niche. Because this is... Everybody has seen the Chappelle show.
Yeah.
You know, it's not just, oh, this certain group that has some pop. No, it's everybody.
You know, when somebody goes, Unity! You know what they're talking about.
Exactly. Or Charlie Murphy. Like, they know. Like, everybody knows. Like,
fuck your couch.
It was, and you just sit here, and we literally just quote it all day. And you can quote
anything. And now
I'm
reliving it in my mind. I'm just seeing that scene. Yeah. It just...
You could, and you
grime
just...
Grime in dirty cowboy boots.
And you could just like, and it's like any, you can quote almost anything, not even the Charlie Murphy stories, but almost any sketch from there, from, you know, any of it, and like people automatically know what you're talking about, you know? But
David Hose David.
Yeah. I didn't get to watch any of that.
Oh, shit, that's Wayne Brady's son!
Is Wayne Brady going to have to choke a bitch?
This podcast is immediately in hijack. It's just going to be an hour of Chappelle shit.
bunch of pasty white dudes doing impressions from the Chappelle show with southern accents. Yeah, that's going to go over well. But that was the same thing. And I didn't get to watch stuff like that because the times that we did have cable or satellite, we did have Comedy Central. So it was one of those things, like, I felt like I was, you know, a kid, and you had to wait till your parents go to sleep, and they had to get up and, you know, watch a nudie movie or whatever. But in my case, being the kid that I was watching Comedy Central. So that was also...
South Park.
Yeah, exactly. So, because I was told, like, my mom, like, told me never watch any of that. And, like, she still to this day, she thinks The Simpsons is the most vulgar TV show to ever be produced on TV. And I'm like, Mom. Like...
There's so much more.
Yeah, exactly. So, I dipped into South Park and some of these other shows. And some of them were just kind of crazy to me. Like, I didn't understand what was going on. And, I started to dip into that, and I vaguely remember watching certain specials. Like, you know, Comedy Central used to have a thing, I don't know if they still do or not, but they'll do, like, Comedy Central Presents, and it'll be, like, a short special or somebody.
I think they still do.
Oh, yeah. And, but I remember watching those. I remember bits and pieces, but, like, who they are, like, the people that are doing, I couldn't tell you, like, who. I just remember, you know, certain bits and stuff, and, just faces, but it's a weird thing. But it's I don't think it's anybody. It could be people that are still doing comedy today. I don't know. But I really didn't get back into it, heavy into it, until started hanging out with this guy, and then he's the one that introduced me. Like, I think the first bit you showed me, I forget how the subject came up, but you told me about Bill Hicks. And he was like, and you were like, man, you ever heard of Bill Hicks? I said, no. He said, man, this guy was a comedian back in the 90s, the 80s and the 90s, and he's buried in fucking Greene County. And I'm like, what? And then the first bit that you showed me or we listened to was this bit about crosses. And I was just like, holy shit. Like, oh, wow, like this type of comedy. Like, I never heard anything like anything against religion or anything like that, because if I was to even remotely come close to any of that, I it would have been over with for me. I would have been grounded for life, or something to that effect.
And that's a fairly mild bit.
Yeah, I know.
Had you seen that bit before you had your aunt? I mean, I think this was a joke that you used in your stand-up about the Christmas.
Oh yeah, no, that happened. That was a, you know, this
was a real.
This was 6 or 7 years ago, because I wasn't 21 very long because I was old enough to drink, but yeah, that actually happened. We were at my grandmother's house, and which was Nanny's house. Mm. My grandma Wanda lives there now. We were at Christmas, and I was having a cigarette with my cousin, and my cousin told me, he said, "You want a beer?" And I was like, and I don't drink in front of the family. Normally mm-hmm. I don't, but at this particular time, I was like, you know what, fuck it. Yeah, I'll have a beer with you. So we had a beer and we're having a cigarette. And his mother comes out there, my aunt. Her name is Karen, by the way.
Perfect.
So you already see where this is going. And she, so she comes out there and she sees us and she says, "What are you boys doing?" And we were like, "Nothing." And he's like, "Are y'all out here?" She's like, "Are y'all out here drinking beer?" And we're like, "Yeah." My cousin goes, "Yeah, mama, you want one?" She goes, "No, I don't want a beer. Y'all ought to be ashamed of yourselves. Y'all are out here drinking beer and on Christmas, on Jesus' birthday." And I was like, "Well, hell, we're celebrating." "Well, hell, let's not check at his suppers. He was turning water into wine, wasn't he?" And she didn't like that.
She did not like
that. Not at all. And I meant it jokingly. And then she was like, "That's blasphemous." And she stormed off. Well, later that day, she texts me. And it wasn't, you know, "Merry Christmas. It was good to see you. How's your mama and them doing?" It was like, "Hey, I only got one question for you.
You believe in God?
Do you even believe in God?" And so I haven't come out to any of my family as my beliefs as far as being atheist or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And but I saw an opportunity to let her know. So so I text her back.
In the most comedic way possible.
I text her back and I said, "Hell, Satan." That was 4 years. That was like 6-7 years ago. I haven't heard from her since. She never texts me. She doesn't
get invited to family Christmases anymore.
Yeah.
You should have taken the more diplomatic route like I do and just say, I consider myself a spiritual free agent.
Then they would have been like, What have you been smoking? You've been smoking the devil's lettuce. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, but you know, I don't gloat about it or, you know, do it, say anything to intentionally hurt somebody's feelings or anything. You know, it's just, I didn't even mean it in a disrespectful way. You know, I was just, you know, get it, you know, but they, so if I watched anything remotely close to that, it would have been over with for me. Like nothing cut off. We were already sheltered as it was. Don't get me wrong. My parents did the best that they could, but when I started learning about other things outside, you know, in the world, because we didn't even have the internet, mm-hmm. you know, my parents saw that as a toy. You know, they didn't really see a necessity or a need for it.
A tool of Satan.
Well, yeah, exactly. Well, see, my dad was afraid that me and my brother were going to wind up like Anthony. We're going to be behind a computer all damn day.
I mean... I can see his point.
Yeah, I see his point, but like when it came to me doing schoolwork.
The fear of Anthony used to hang over everything.
Yeah, I know, right? Especially my dad was like, "Oh, my boys aren't going to turn out like that." No, so, well, we didn't.
Mission accomplished.
Mission accomplished.
Have you seen your mother, baby, standing in the shadows with a look of indecision on her face? Have you ever wondered how she looked when she was younger and decisions weren't things she had to make? Did you see your father, baby, there beside your mother, laughing with his arm around your waist? Have you ever wondered how they were when they were younger and the only thing they had to lose was faith? stuck out on all the smart ones, ran to bigger town. You didn't need the siren call to leave. And is it any wonder now? Was it ever?
Started learning about different types of comedy, learning that there's more than just get her done, and you know, and then like I said, Kim was a big, like, oh, you need to listen to these guys.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, my as Bill Hicks would say, my third eye was squeegee cleaned from then on.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then not only just that, but just like me and him, we'd also talk about, you know, movies and too, because when I left the jail, when I was a prison guard. Everybody that's listening, I went and locked up. When I quit doing that, when I first went to college, I wanted to go to school for filmmaking. So, and because that's what I wanted to do. Because just me and him would talk about it. And I was like, dude, like, I got all these ideas I would do. Like, I would love to get into that and learning how to do that. So, you know, I just did 380, whatever, or 180. I don't know fucking math. I turned around. I quit doing law enforcement and everything, and I just realized that's just not what I want to do. Mm-hmm. So, and then I started, you know, expanding my ideas and such. So,
well, let's move there, man. Let's talk about film work for a while, because I mean, just some of the posts Justin's made is like, it's turned me on to different films that I probably wouldn't have found or known to check out.
Oh yeah.
And talk about people like Werner Herzog.
Yeah.
And just different cats like that. Let's move off there, man. So, I mean, I'm from a small town in Northwest Alabama, and it's like you have to find people who are actually into this kind of stuff.
You gotta find a guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, how'd that happen, Justin? It's like, how'd you get that stuff?
Yeah, the thing with film, man, like, I tell you what happened was, I guess it was around, yeah, it's gotta be around 1999, whenever the Phantom Menace
came out. I knew you were gonna say the Phantom Menace.
Dude, I shit you not, my love of film, or like, obviously I like movies before that.
Right, right.
But, like, the path to me becoming, like, this, you know, like, whatever, cinephile, what have you, just, you know, obsessed with films, it started in 99, Phantom Menace is coming out, I got wrapped up in the hype, you see, I mean, come on, everybody remember seeing that trailer for the first time?
Oh, God, yeah. That was the first Star Wars movie I ever saw in theaters.
Incredible. The visuals in that film are still incredible. Yeah. And that is a whole other conversation.
Oh, yeah,
My defense of the prequels.
Yeah, same. But,
anyway, it's okay. So it started...
We'll get into that for a bit.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, so 4, 5, 6. I remember as a kid watching those. Mm-hmm. But episode 1, I remember watching that Star Wars film probably more than any other.
Yeah, I did too.
And then as I got older, I went back and watched it. And I was like, this just isn't good.
Mm-hmm.
And then I sit down with a Star Wars fan. And we're watching episode 1.
Mm-hmm.
And he was just going into it. He was like, this might be the best one.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, interesting. And as he starts breaking down, like, Star Wars, and I was like, I thought it was just hard garbage. So let's talk about this.
It is interesting. Now, I guess it's just because of the passage of time. Mm-hmm. Okay, I mean, I started off, obviously, 4, 5, and 6.
Right.
That's always going to be, like, my original Star Wars, just because of when I was born. I'm the product of my time, like a lot of people are. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, the prequels, like, I saw, you know, I was, like, 12, 13, when The Phantom Menace came out, and I remember my expectations were, I was like, eh, it didn't live up to the hype, but I mean, I don't think any film could have lived up to the hype of The Phantom Menace. I mean, that was the cinematic equivalent of the Second Coming of Christ.
Yeah, for anybody, because you gotta remember too, it was like, what, 20 years in between Return of the Jedi? 16 years.
And it's like, Lucas has not made any more stars. He'd hardly made any films. He's done, you know, after Jedi, he did Temple of Doom and Last Crusade.
Right.
And he did that, the Willow movie.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
It's fine.
Val Kilmer. Was it Val Kilmer?
Yeah, it was Val Kilmer. Yeah. And Warwick Davis, who played Wicket.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
So, yeah, I mean, he had done a lot, and then, you know, he did the special editions, and
It's kind of like...
People bitch about those.
It's kind of the equivalent of when Dave Chappelle came back and did a special. You know, he...
Yeah, after, I can see that.
Yeah, after Chappelle's show, like, he went, you know, went to Africa, mm-hmm. 10 years, didn't really do anything. He'd do stand-up at small places. He'd just show up and do stand-up. Mm-hmm. But when his special got announced, the Netflix broke. Like, it was like, holy shit. You know, but yeah, and see, like, you were talking about, like, your expectations for the movie. See, and this is our age difference, because the movie came out in 99. I was 8. Mm-hmm. And you said you were 13, 12, 13.
Yeah, 12, 13.
See, I was just, that was the very first Star Wars movie I ever went to go see. Now, before that, the only movies that I saw in theaters, which was the very first movie I ever saw, was Batman Forever. So, which, that kicked off my love of Batman and everything, too.
Yeah, you know? Never got to see Jurassic Park at theaters.
No, I didn't.
You missed out.
I did.
You missed out.
I did. But,
I gotta rub that in your face.
But, but yeah, but, like, for me, watching it was, you know, I'm like, I didn't really understand at first. Another kid at school, who was a bigger nerd than I was, he had more information. He was kind of like the inside guy. He was telling me, he said, no, this is what happened before Luke, and I was like, oh, okay. So I had that idea, and it was just it was new to me, because I didn't know what to expect, really, you know. But but my big thing for me was the lightsaber duels, Darth Maul showing up, young Obi-Wan Kenobi, and how, you know, and Obi-Wan is my favorite Star Wars character, period.
That's it, man.
And yeah, it's so seeing that battle between them two, because before then, and that's what Lucas wanted to do, he wanted to have the prime of the Jedi, because before then we just saw Luke versus Vader and Vader versus Obi-Wan.
Yeah.
And it wasn't a whole lot of, it was more of,
what's that Lucas quote, it's like yeah, back in the original films all you saw was robots and sort of, you know, grizzled old men fighting one another very slow.
Yeah,
we're not gonna do that. It's gonna be the prime of the Jedi. They're gonna be flying, they're gonna be superheroes.
Yeah. So, but that's watching that it's still, like, it chokes me up every time, because when that music starts playing, Duel of the Fates, and Darth Maul shows up, and we see a two-bladed lightsaber, I crap myself, and then just that it kicks off, and it's just dun 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 dun, and they just go into it. Just that whole fight scene alone, just with them, was just that. That's what really, you know. And I was like, me being the kid that learning martial arts and everything, I was like, I want a lightsaber. I want to use a lightsaber.
Oh,
so yeah.
9 movies in, I can say now authoritatively, single greatest lightsaber duel in the entire Star Wars saga.
Yo, hell yeah, I agree with that 100%. You know, people would come out and be like, no, Luke and Vader at the Return of the Jedi. Mm-mm. No, I mean, it was still good, but Duel of the Fates, though, you know, that to me is that's the best one out of them all. Yeah, I think
R.I.P. Qui-Gon.
Yeah
pour one out. But yeah, like, you know, even at the time, even though it didn't live up to expectations, mm-hmm. I never disliked it.
Yeah.
And, like, when I got it on video and watched it again, like, when I got it, the VHS the day it came out, I think I watched that movie, like, 3 times.
Yeah.
And, like, I mean, I had issues with it. I mean, obviously Lucas is not Tarantino when it comes to writing dialogue. He never was, he never will be.
Yeah.
If you go back and read original reviews of Star Wars A New Hope, critics trashed him for his wooden dialogue.
Yeah.
What did they do 22 years later? They trashed him for his wooden dialogue.
Yeah.
It's all, I mean, look, you know, I don't go to Star Wars films to hear Shakespearean soliloquies.
Yeah.
That's not what they're about. And
no.
I mean, when you look at, and now that we've seen the Disney Star Wars films, you know, and basically what they were trying to do was, like, I mean, you know, they tried to completely change the format that Lucas set up for the prequels and his approach to films. They said, we're going to have more animatronics.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're shooting on film again. It's like, okay. And, yeah, I mean, they were basically doing, I mean, the J.J. film, there's a reason why they call it a sequel slash reboot.
Mm-hmm.
Is they were basically trying to whitewash everything that Lucas did with the prequels because of this overwhelming notion that, oh, these were terrible films that everyone hated because a few assholes were really loud on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of blew up in their face because it's like, you know, they're trying to pay for, I mean, it's the fan service trilogy, in my opinion, the sequel
mm-hmm.
trilogy. I mean, Rian Johnson, he was doing some interesting things in Last Jedi that I know a lot of people didn't like. And, you know, to be fair, I don't think any of those films are bad films.
Mm-hmm.
I just think that if it had been Lucas still making those films, he would have gone in more interesting directions than what those films were.
Yeah.
They were basically trying to remake 4, 5, and 6.
Yeah. And you watch 7. I mean, it's basically the plot set up the same way as A New Hope.
And
I mean, yeah.
Looking back at the prequel trilogy through that lens, seeing as what Disney tried to do as opposed to what Lucas was doing with his films. And like Episode 2, there's a lot of stuff in that film that I like. I adore Christopher Lee in that movie. I mean, you know, to me that man can do no wrong. If Christopher Lee shows up in a movie, and also, I mean, and then there's just small details. Like, we'll take this because I could talk about Christopher Lee forever. But, you know, it's known that, you know, Christopher Lee was in the Hammer horror film series, did a lot of, you know, Dracula films, Frankenstein, The Mummy, did a lot of those films co-starring with Peter Cushing, who played Grand Moff Tarkin in Episode 4. And there's a shot in Episode 2. It's one of the first shots you see of Christopher Lee when he's on Geonosis and he's at that round table. And he's sitting there at the head of the round table and the camera is panning around the table at all the different characters while he's having this, you know, commanding dialogue with them. And it's the exact mirror of one of the first scenes you see in A New Hope with Peter Cushing.
Oh, I didn't think
this
about
actor,
that.
You know, the one actor that he's been most identified with.
Oh my God, I didn't even think about
that.
That's like the first opening where it shows every, you know, and they're like, this is the most powerful space station.
The last remnants of the Old Republic have been swept away.
Yeah.
Yeah, that scene. But yeah, I mean, I just like small details.
He just blew my mind.
Yeah. I just like small details that Lucas put in there like that. These films are not as shallow. It's all, it's just a video game. No, there's more depth to these films. I mean, and to me, like, I mean, people can shit on some of Hayden Christensen's acting.
Yeah.
But, like, the scene where he goes and lays waste to the Tusken Raiders
after
his mother dies, that's a great scene.
That was.
And there, to me, it's one of the rawest scenes emotionally in any of the Star Wars films. And, I will gladly debate anyone on that.
Yeah.
For these films that say, oh, they're wooden, there's no emotion, there's no character development, there's no plot.
No, there was, man.
Yeah.
I mean, the whole, how does the Republic become an empire? How do good people turn bad?
Yeah.
There's more of a narrative arc in the prequel trilogy than maybe any of the other six films. I mean,
people shit on...
This is how Darth Vader became Vader.
Yeah, and people shit...
this is how a man
shit on
who,
Hayden Christensen,
who,
but...
Who thought he was going to be Jesus turned into Hitler. I mean...
Yeah. And you know, people... Like
you're supposed
said,
to be the chosen one.
Yeah. And people... And that was another scene, too.
Yeah,
like, you want to talk about Raw...
That's high drama, man.
...was Obi-Wan Kenobi, where he just breaks down. He says, you are the chosen one! Like, he got into... Ewan McGregor's a fantastic actor anyway, but... But seeing that too, and growing up with those movies too, because like I said, that was the first Star Wars movie I saw in theaters. So by the time 3 came out, I'm not going to lie, Order 66, I was crying. Like, that, y'all make fun of me all you want, but when they...
Oh, yeah, kill a little...
Well, I'm getting chills right now, man.
Yeah, like, when they... Just the way they shot it...
It's a genocide.
It was... Yeah, and... For me, with Star Wars, is the Jedi Order. And in the original trilogy, we just know what Obi-Wan told Luke about him. And that was it.
Mm-hmm.
And then, but getting to see the Jedi Order and the Council, and, of course, Samuel Jackson show up, and just, like, how the Order was and how they operated... And then getting to see them, and you do get attached to some of the characters in a way, you know. And then, like, Order 66, when that happened, that was another one. But also with Hayden Christensen, though, is like him turning into Vader. The one scene, you know, when they storm the Jedi Temple,
ooh.
And then the look on his face too when he goes into the room with the younglings, like he looks like a man that he doesn't want to do this, like he's got tears in his eyes, but he knows he has to. And then the scene where he goes to Mustafar, and then he kills all of the Nuke Gunray and all the rest of the Separatists, and he's kind of standing there, and he's got his hood on, and he's just sitting there, and he's just crying, because he just... I think inside he knows that Anakin Skywalker is dead, and there's a part of him that didn't want to let that go, because he knows what it means to let go of that life. So that was another scene for me that just, like, you know, just you see it. It's just more, like you said, it's a raw scene that you see, that you know, we haven't really seen that in the... I don't think we've seen that in the newer ones.
Disney, the whole killing off the younglings, all that.
Yeah.
Like Anakin Skywalker being immolated.
Yeah.
Disney ain't never gonna go that hard in their movies.
Yeah.
We all know it.
Yeah. I tell you another what's also crazy too that I found out. I just saw it was something that I saw on Facebook, and then I was like, oh, I wonder. So apparently in the scene where which is simultaneously the scene that Luke and Leia are being born, they're being born, but also Vader's being born. Anakin's going through everything, and he's getting the suit put on him. Right before the mask falls onto his face, his last breath that you vaguely hear it, right before the mask shuts down, you hear him say, "Padme, help me." And then that mask shuts, and then it kicks up.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, you didn't know that? I saw that, and I was like, that can't be true. And I went back, and I listened to it, and I was like, I can hear it.
Mm.
Now, I don't know if it was a placebo effect, but you can... There's a guy on YouTube that took the sound and amplified it to where you can hear him. It's like he's exhaling out his last breath. He's exhaling out, and he says, "Padme, help me."
Mm.
And then it shuts. Yeah. So, you know, little things like that, you just, that Lucas put into there, because you could tell he cared so much about these
characters. Well, it's his world.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I know that had to have been extremely hard for him to pass that off to somebody else, or at least... to see what they've done with them since, but still having the sense of knowing that, okay, they own these characters, they're gonna still do their own thing. So
no,
you don't think...
you know what Lucas's original plan was before he outright sold off the company to Disney.
Uh-huh.
Before the sequel trilogy was started.
Uh-huh.
His plan was he himself was gonna make Episode 7, write and direct Episode 7.
Right.
Then he was at. Then after he completed that, he was going to sell the company and send it off. To me, I mean, God knows what would have happened with 8 and 9 in that scenario, but I much prefer that scenario.
That would have been interesting. But yeah. Disney would have known. Okay, all right. Well, we're starting a new trilogy. Whatever he does, we have to branch off of that. And they didn't want to do that. They wanted to take over from the beginning. So they try to take a lot of anything that had his fingerprint on it still. They wanted to get rid of it. Lucas' involvement, its original stories, its different stuff, just using the world, basically. So I had a feeling when they took over, I knew. I said, they're gonna get rid of... After I saw 7 and with Han Solo, I was like, they're gonna... Because, you know, Harrison Ford got tired of it anyway. He probably wanted that to happen to him anyway.
Can't you just kill off Han Solo already?
Yeah. But I had a feeling, like, they're gonna start cutting. They're gonna start cutting these characters out.
Isn't there been in every Lucas film ever made?
What?
Han Solo.
Harrison Ford?
Harrison Ford. Has he been in every Lucasfilm ever?
He's been in a lot of them, like, because he was, he wasn't in Lucas's first film, THX 1138, but, he had a bit part in American Graffiti.
Yeah.
Which Lucas did right before Star Wars.
THX 1138 was his, college
film,
wasn't it?
Yeah, he did it as a short, and then, he met up with Francis Coppola, and those two came in cahoots with one another. They started, Coppola started his company, American Zoetrope.
Oh, okay.
They made THX 1138. They put Robert Duvall in it, because, I mean, you know, that's, obviously he's been associated with Coppola for a long time. This was,
right.
This was pre-Godfather.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And, so yeah, like, he does that movie, it bombs. He does American Graffiti, because Francis was like, you need to make just a lighthearted comedy. He's like, make yourself make a lighthearted comedy. Just don't do this, like, dystopian science fiction. And, he's like, well, okay, I'll see what I can do, Francis. So, yeah, like, Harrison Ford was cast in a bit part in American Graffiti. And then, like, he showed Lynn Lucas is doing Star Wars, and he's working out of the Zoetrope offices in San Francisco, and he's trying to cast the movie. And, like, dude, we can do a whole podcast about the actors that were that were considered for Han Solo.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
One of them being...
Christopher Walken.
Yeah, I want to see that movie.
Jack Nicholson.
Oh my god.
Jeez.
Tom Selleck.
No, that was Indy.
Oh, that was Indy. Yeah. That's right.
Oh, right. Oh, Al Pacino. I want to see. I want to go to the alternate universe where Al Pacino is Han Solo.
I want to see the Christopher Walken one.
That one too.
Just because of the cantina scene.
Yeah, but so yeah, like, there's all these big actors that are being considered, and Ford was a nobody at that point. He was, like, literally, I mean, he was a carpenter. Ford was an actor, so he's doing some carpentry work.
He was already in his 30s, too.
Yeah, he was doing some carpentry work with Coppola, and Lucas is like, hey, Ford, what are you doing up there? I got this part I want you to read for. So Harrison reluctantly comes down and reads for the part that makes his career.
Yeah.
So they do Star Wars, they do Empire. And then Lucas is getting with Spielberg to make Raiders. They have Tom Selleck cast as Indy already. But then somebody from CBS comes over and says, wait, we have a contract with Tom Selleck to do this show called Magnum P.I. Tom can't be in your film. So they're like, crap, what do we do now? We've lost Tom Selleck. Who are we going to have as Indy? And Steven was the one that suggested to George. He said, why don't you cast Harrison? And at first, Lucas, he said, Steven, I've already had him in like three or four of my movies. You know, I don't want this guy to be my Bob De Niro, referring to, you know, Bob De Niro and Scorsese, all the movies they did together. I don't want ever to have every movie that I make star Harrison.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean well, he, obviously he's the right choice.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, technically, I mean, Steven Spielberg directed Indy, so I know George wrote him, but
it's his character.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
That's how I think about Lucas's films, man. It's almost like a Tarantino thing because, you know, Tarantino usually picks from the same tree with most of his films.
And you're going to see Leo,
you're going to see Pitt, you're going to see Samuel Jackson, L. Jackson, yeah.
Yeah.
You're going to see those guys, and it's like different roles.
Yeah.
And,
Christopher Nolan does the same thing.
Yeah.
There's a lot of actors, Tim Burton with Johnny Depp.
Mm-hmm. I wish they would do another movie together.
Yeah.
It's been a while.
Yeah.
Johnny Depp was on a weird... Mm-hmm. He's got some flack at him right now.
Yeah, like, well, he's in that...
divorce and...
Yeah, the ongoing thing with him and his ex-wife where she came out about 4 years ago and claimed that Johnny Depp hit her.
Mm-hmm.
And, had pictures of what appeared to be a bruise and... Mm-hmm. But then at the time, people were coming out saying, like... And... Like, this is how I treat any, like, public scandal. Like,
this was the hype of the Me Too movement, too, right?
This was a little bit before. It was about a year before.
Mm-hmm.
But then it kind of, you know, bled over because it's been this ongoing thing. And cases like that, I always say, if it's multiple women accusing one man, there's probably fire where there's smoke.
Yeah.
If it's just one woman accusing one man of a thing, and there's all these other women that have had relationships with man said... He absolutely never was inappropriate to me. You know, that's when you gotta say, eh.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, don't really check out.
You know, and, they're in a... Apparently, Johnny Depp has all this surveillance footage. And all these recordings where she admits to hitting him. Like, hit him with a vodka bottle.
Yeah, wine bottle.
What was it? Burn him with a cigarette butt and just...
Yeah.
Insanity.
Mm-hmm. Well, there was a lot of reports, stuff coming out, too, from her from the, you know, she was in the Aquaman movie.
Not
she played, yeah, she plays Mera, which is Aquaman's wife. And there was a lot of stuff coming out from there, too, from people being on set about how she treated people, you know, and her passive-aggressive or threatening manners that mm-hmm. she had. There's a lot going on so with
she's
that
like,
also.
She's like Ellen.
That's where I was about to go. Yeah. It seems like since, you know, the quarantine, it's like there's been so much just coming out of all these, you know, Hollywood people like Ellen. She just totally treats her staff and everybody like trash. She's a garbage person.
Yeah.
Quarantine has hyper-accelerated cancellation.
Yeah, for real.
I've noticed this because I tend to hang out in a particular pit of hell and doom known as Twitter. And Twitter tells me things.
Yeah. But
a lot of it not good.
Yeah.
It's a brush fire. The Blips, Inside Out. The song before was Justin Peter Kinkelschuster, Educated Guesses. We're hopping right back in on conversations about Werner Herzog.
Yeah, man, Werner Herzog, one of our great living filmmakers, and today is his 78th birthday, by the way.
How do you say happy birthday in German?
I have no idea.
This guy sounds angry.
But, like, if you were like, hey, Werner, happy birthday, he would be like, what is so happy about it? What is so happy about this day, which signifies one day, one year closer to infinite demise and eternal darkness? Or whatever.
It's like he's in the room with us.
The way he chooses to narrate his films. But yeah, I could do that impression forever and have been doing it for like the last 10 years.
So let's get into it. Just growing up is crazy.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about Werner, he was born in, you know, Germany in 1942 in the middle of World War II. From what I've read, according to the reports, or at least what he has said, I mean, I don't know if he's embellishing his legend. I don't think he really has to. But he claims that a bomb fell on his house when he was just a few days old. And, you know, that started a very somewhat traumatic upbringing in a post-war Germany in which the country had just been entirely decimated by the war. On top of, you know, everyone alive at the time having to contend with the legacy of Nazism and the horrific things that their country had done to the world, and, you know, specifically, you know, to the Jews in Europe and all of the other countless dead around the world. And so, you know, he grows up very poor. I think I once read where, like, he and his brother, like, they had to, in order to get something to eat, they had to learn how to shoot down crows to cook. And he, like, I think he said he didn't even know what a film was until he was maybe like 14 or 16 years old. But like as soon as he encountered, you know, the magic of film, he knew that it was his destiny to become this filmmaker, and just became this thing that he would achieve by sheer force of will. And, you know, eventually he gets into films. You know, his subjects, you know, he does documentary features, he does, you know, dramatic film, you know, he does fiction films, and, like, they're both similar in a lot of ways. Like, the documentary films have a bit of embellishment to them. It's not straightforward. He does like to do sort of, you know, fantastic, crazy things in his documentaries, the way that I think he may even, like, direct the interviewees and how he wants them to perform for the camera. You know, he doesn't just turn on the camera and just, you know, says, you know, fly with it. And on the opposite side of that coin, his feature films, his fiction films, have a very documentarian feel in a way to a lot of them. He uses a lot of handheld camera, for instance. Like, I was just rewatching his remake of Nosferatu the other night, and you know, there's a lot of, like, handheld shots in that one. That really wasn't a big thing in feature films at the time. So that was interesting, and that was in the 70s. And another way that, you know, his feature films are almost have a documentarian, or whatever, approach to them, is because the making of the films themselves was such an epic ordeal. Like, I mean, you know, he's, to take one film for example, Fitzcarraldo, which it takes place in the 19th century. It's about this man, I believe I'm assuming he has to be German, European, you know, whatever, who finds himself in the middle of the Amazon jungle, and he is hell-bent on building an opera house in the middle of the jungle. He wants to bring civilization into the heart of chaos. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he sets about down the Amazon in this, you know, steamboat, and he comes to a point where there's a mountain separating these two river streams. And so he realizes that the only way to get around it is he has to have the local natives help him to pull this ship over a mountain. And, I mean, that's a story point in the film, but as they were making the film, they actually had to hire local natives as extras to pull a very real ship over a mountain, an actual mountain in the middle of South America. And It was a film that, like, literally Herzog could not get funding because he would go to the studios and he would describe to them, you know, oh, hey, runner, you know, what's your plan for this film? You know, how are you going to, you know, pull this ship over a mountain? Are you going to use, like, a little model, special effects or whatever? And he would tell them, you know, he's like, no, we are not going to use models to pull this ship over a mountain. We are going to pull an actual ship over a mountain. And as soon as I told them that, they would show me the door. They had no interest in mounting a production of this magnitude. So, like, it took him years to get it made. And, like, he finally starts shooting. He has the actor Jason Robards cast as the main character Fitzcarraldo. Interestingly enough, this version of the film, he had a sidekick character who I believe was, like, some sort of mentally challenged individual played by Mick Jagger of all people.
Jesus Christ.
So, wow. Werner Herzog has this legendary actor, Jason Robards, and the biggest rock star in the world, Mick Jagger, in the middle of the Amazon rainforest shooting this insane epic. Unfortunately, they get about halfway through production. Jason Robards has a massive heart attack. Doctors say, absolutely not, you're finished. You know, you gotta go back to L.A. At the same time, you know, the clock is ticking. Mick Jagger, unfortunately, has to go back to his day job. The Rolling Stones have a new tour coming up. So, Mick goes to Werner. And so Werner is left in the middle of the jungle with his dick in his hand, and he's saying, how am I going to finish this film?
Mm-hmm.
And so he manages to go back to one of his old stalwarts, an actor named Klaus Kinski, who, if anyone is familiar with his work, was a crazy person. It has been well documented on camera, behind the scenes, of just these insane outbursts that he would have, literally out of the blue.
Now, who's this guy? Like, what's some of his work that he's done?
Klaus Kinski, I don't know how well known he is to America audiences. I mean, he was in For a Few Dollars More with Clint Eastwood. I think what else he would have been in. He did a Dracula film with Christopher Lee that I just saw not too long ago. He's pretty good in that. But, like, he's mostly known for his films with Werner Herzog and just how crazy he was. Like, I mean, there's literally, like, there was a behind-the-scenes documentary that was shot at Fitzcarraldo, which has a lot of great footage. And it just shows Kinski just flying off the handle, just, fuck you, damn you, this place is like a fucking prison, blah, 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 the food is shit.
I remember you showing me that, you know, and they're just yelling at each other in German. He's just yelling,
get this man out of my fucking face, blah, 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 you know, and Werner's like, please, Klaus, calm down, we have to finish the film. Fuck you, Werner, I will shoot you.
He showed me that when he told me about Werner Herzog, and he was telling me, he went on this tirade about this movie, and he said, you gotta watch this movie, it's just like behind the scenes, it's just crazy. And then he shows me this video, and I'm just watching this, and they're like yelling at each other in German. I'm like, holy shit.
Like, it's literally like, it's one of the, it has to be one of the inspirations for Tropic Thunder.
I love that movie, man. I'm glad that came up.
Yeah.
Like that and the behind the scenes of Apocalypse Now. Like,
oh yeah.
Those are the two most insane productions, like, has to be ever in film history. It's like, how the fuck did these two films get made?
Oh my god.
And yeah, Tropic Thunder, like, they had to, like, been watching Burden of Dreams, the Fitzcarraldo documentary, where it's like Werner's just like, he's talking about the birds and just like how this place is just a dark, evil place. He says, I hear the sound of the birds singing unto me. They are not singing, it sounds as though they are screeching in pain. He says, this jungle to me is like overwhelming collective murder. I mean, it's next level shit. It's so great. And it's like, you know, when I first started getting into Herzog, and, like, I'm watching these, like, interviews, and it's like, how can you not love this guy? Like, this is a man, he has traveled to all seven continents to make films. He went to Antarctica to shoot a movie about, like, the people that work there, and about, like, how it represents, like, this represents the end of the world to him, and, like, what the planet's gonna become, and he goes in this whole bit about how, like, the only sustainable life on Earth is sponges. I mean, the dude's fucking wild. And he's also in The Mandalorian. He is the would-be murderer of Baby Yoda.
There, we're back to Star Wars.
That's where America...
Full circle!
Yeah.
That's where America has learned to love Werner Herzog, is as the... What's his name? The client in The Mandalorian. Yeah. He is the man responsible for a practical Baby Yoda. Because he was giving interviews when Mando came out, and he was saying about, like, how he would, like... He said, I would see this little baby robot on set, and I would look at him, and he was so heartbreakingly beautiful. And they said at the time they were considering replacing him with the computer, generated character. And I said, do not do that. I said, keep the puppet. If you do not, you are cowards. And they kept it. I mean, Werner scared him straight. And would Baby Yoda have been as popular as a CG character?
Oh my god.
The world might never know.
Never know.
Oh my god.
So yeah, that's an introduction of Werner Herzog.
There you go. You have been well informed.
Go to YouTube, just look that motherfucker up. Hours of fun.
Anything else to do with movies, we can always hop right back, but I wanted to go music with y'all for a bit.
Hey man.
Yeah.
I'm all about music. It's Mother Great Love.
Yeah.
So real. Man, give me a feel for your taste. What are you into?
Oh man, you know, like, I like to think of myself as, like, I'm into everything. Like, I mean, obviously, like, my primary wheelhouse, like, the stuff that, like, I'm closest to, like, number one, out of the gate, my single favorite artist of all time is David Bowie.
Okay.
I mean, like, you know, after he, like, I sort of came to that realization after he died. Because it's like, I knew that I would be bummed out, like, whenever he eventually died. But, like, when he did, like, I was surprised how hard I took that.
I text you.
Yeah, you were the guy that, you were the guy I got the news from, which is wild.
Yeah.
Are you okay?
I saw that. I was like, dude. And I was like, it was almost one of those where I was like, do you need me to come over? Are you okay? You need anything?
Yeah.
But it was like, but yeah, I remember seeing that, and that was the first thought that I had in my head. I was like, he is going to be devastated.
You familiar with Lily Hyatt?
Not.
Okay, she's out of Nashville. She has a song called The Night David Bowie Died.
Ooh, I have heard that. Yes.
Tremendous song. That's, and I think it kind of captures... Like that, you know, the opening line in the song kind of captures, like, the way that it felt for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to call you the night that David Bowie died, but I just sat in my room and cried.
Yeah.
I'm not gonna lie, dude. I got up, like, I mean, I was just shocked. I looked at my, you know, I looked at my Twitter feed, Facebook, and it's just all him.
Yeah. You know,
everybody shouting out their condolences and shock and whatnot. And, like... Like, I didn't cry or anything. I was just like in shock. I'm like, oh my god, like, this dude just dropped a new record 2 days ago and it was incredible.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then you start thinking about those music videos and you're like, oh, he was telling us that he was going to die.
Yeah.
And now I remember, like, he dropped that really weird Black Star video with all that occult imagery in it. And it's like, I didn't know what that was about. Like, there was an astronaut and a skeleton inside an astronaut suit and all this. And it's like, wait a second, that was Major Tom. Major Tom is dead now.
Mm.
And just like, just the urgency that was in that. Like, it felt like, okay, like when I first heard that song, I'm like, this is the best thing he's done since the 70s.
Yeah.
Like, this guy, he's on something. I don't know what this guy, I don't know. You know, what's happening with this guy right now.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, he is firing on all cylinders like he hasn't done in decades.
Mm-hmm. He was looking rough there towards the end.
There
too.
Was a sense of... like, there was just this sense of urgency in the music. And it's like, when we found out he died, it's like, yeah, it all makes sense now.
Wasn't he battling cancer for several years and nobody really knew about it except his son, Duncan Jones?
Yeah, a few people knew. They said about a year and a half.
About a year and a half.
Yeah, and like hardly anybody knew. It was like one of those, like, kind of like Chadwick Boseman.
That's where he decided.
He said, I'm not going to tell anybody. I'm just going to fight this. Mm-hmm. I'm going to fight this battle alone.
Yeah.
The director of Black Panther, you know, Owen Bosman, he said he didn't even let the cast know. I mean, he literally didn't tell. He just came in, did his work,
yeah,
and fought the battle silently.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was.
That was tough too, man.
He was. He also got me into Bowie too, and just, you know, for the longest time, like, for example, I've heard the song before, Under Pressure, Queen, but didn't realize Bowie was in it, you know. And then he got me into Bowie and listening, and then of course I've heard he's like, you've heard Space Oddity, right? And I'm like, yeah, of course. And that kind of introduced me into it later. And then our two favorite bands combined, because I'm a huge Pink Floyd fan.
Mm-hmm.
And Bowie, David Bowie, was really close with David Gilmour, one of the mm-hmm. guitar players and singers for Pink Floyd. And they did a show together, too. So that was, you know, and he showed me that, too. And then that kind of dipped me into getting more into Bowie, because I didn't really know much about the dude, yeah. really.
That the thing about David Bowie and, you know,
mm-hmm.
that era is, when you look at your favorite musicians today,
mm-hmm.
and then they tell you the people that they were listening to that yeah. inspired them, then you go and look. It's like a tree.
Mm-hmm.
Then you look at who inspired them.
Mm-hmm.
The road is, it'll either be some old blues cat from Mississippi, you know, that this is why I do this, or it's a cat like David Bowie. It's mm-hmm. like the cornerstone of yeah. today's music. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people, it just blows right by them. It's like, if yeah. you're into this, you should definitely look at the influence, because you're mm-hmm. going to be into that.
Yeah. I remember watching one interview that he did, I think it was with MTV,
mm-hmm.
where he was putting them through. He said, why aren't y'all showing, if this is music television, why are y'all not showing these other artists, mm-hmm. specifically from the African-American community, or these other genres? And they were like, oh, well, we're primarily this. He said, well, and he was basically saying, he said, his influences come from all over.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, like, and then you could definitely hear that in his music, too, because me being ignorant that I was with music and bands, it was just like, okay, this is what this band sounds like. This is what it always sounds like. Then you listen to artists like him, and it's just, I don't know how to explain it. It's just, he's just covered so much of what he wanted to do with his work.
I mean, we were talking outside when we took a break about just the ability of music to go somewhere, and that a lot of times it doesn't have to be just one way. That
right.
It can have multiple levels and it can have multiple feels, and David Bowie was definitely, I don't know about saying the first, but a pioneer for that thought and doing it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he never repeated himself.
Right.
Right.
You know, like, once he, you know, got what he wanted, once he, you did what he wanted to do, what he wanted to say with one iteration of his work, okay, let's change it up, you know. Mm-hmm. I've done Ziggy Stardust. Let's kill off Ziggy. Let's do something else, you know. Let's go do an R&B record in Philadelphia with Luther Vandross.
Yeah.
You know, okay, I'm done with this. Let me go over to Germany and record this weird electronic music with Brian Eno and do shit with Iggy Pop. Okay, I'm done with this. I'll do this and that and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't keep himself confined into his creative expression.
And a great collaborator. I mean, like yeah. you were just saying, he was always collaborating with different... I mean, we brought up Queen, Under Pressure.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
Iggy Pop. And
mm-hmm.
I mean, I love collaborations, man.
Oh, yeah.
And so what else, man? Tom York, Radiohead.
Yeah, Radiohead. Like, my sort of, like, wheelhouse is, like, this weird, like, British art rock guys, like Bowie, Radiohead, Brian Eno, then you got, like, you know, stuff like Talking Heads, Joy Division, Velvet Underground, all Lou Reed stuff. And, but, like, also, I mean, like, I'm really into, like, I will say, my second favorite artist of all time is from a completely different wheelhouse, and that's Willie Nelson.
Yep.
Like, oh, yeah. I adore that man.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, his music gives me chills, you know? Like, to me, that man is, like, America's single living greatest musician. He's one of the greatest songwriters we've ever produced. He's one of the most, I mean, he's one of the most, he has one of the most unique voices. And he's an masterful, virtuoso guitarist. I mean, when you hear Willie Nelson's guitar, you know it's Willie Nelson.
Yeah.
What else, man? Educate us on the Cure a little bit.
Oh, the Cure. I mean... You know, like, I mean, they come out of that time in British rock. You know, I mean, obviously, you know, they're a product of the punk movement.
I mean, they come just right after, you know, the Sex Pistols, the Clash, the Damned,
yeah,
all those bands. So, like, you know, I mean, they're in the middle of all that, you know, like, you know, they're in the studio next to Joy Division, who's recording something. And so, yeah, I mean, they started in, like, their early work, it's in a very similar vein to, like, a lot of, like, punk, post-punk work. And like, even, hell, I mean, even, like, Robert Smith, like, he's compared himself to, he said his early idea of what he wanted The Cure to be, like, he wanted to be, like, Elvis Costello. Which, I mean, like, if you hear that, was it Three Imaginary Boys, like, the first album, like, there's some songs on there that have a Costello vibe to them. But then just, like, you know, but then he just, almost like Bowie, he evolves. You know, he goes from that sort of early post-punk, you know, stuff to, you know, moving more into, like, a goth rock direction. And then, you know, like, he puts out, there's that three, there's a trilogy of albums that ends with that album, Pornography. What was it? I think it's 17 Seconds, Faith, and Pornography. And he's, like, each one gets subsequently more goth, you know, like, you know, like, real, like, reverb, heavy, you know, just minimal guitar lines, whatever, et cetera, et cetera. And then it gets really dark with Pornography. Like, it's, like, one of the darkest records they've ever made. And then at that point, he kind of, like, bottoms out. And he says, okay, I want to mix it up again. And then, like, starts moving into, like, she's, like, doing, like, these crazy pop songs that people didn't think he was capable of doing. And then just what's interesting with Robert Smith and The Cure is just how, over the years, back and forth, they've been able to go through, like, you know, they'll go from, like, these really atmospheric, gloomy songs, and then they can do, like, these happy, upbeat, you know, pop songs. I mean
and just
like
heaven.
Yeah, and, like, everybody totally accepts it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, nobody hates on, like, the goths don't hate on him for it. Like, I mean, you know, for example, like, if Trent, you know, if Trent Reznor tried to do that with Nine Inch Nails, he would get so much shit. He did it with one song. I think it was called Everything. It was off of the album Hesitation Marks. It's the closest that Nine Inch Nails have ever come to making, to recording a happy song.
Mm-hmm.
And he got shit for it. It's like, no, it's great. It's like, I would like to hear him do more of this. But yeah, Robert Smith, he's the guy that got away with it. Still gets away with it.
Yeah.
And that's what I've always, I mean, that's what I've always respected about him.
What else? What else? What other music? I'm trying to pick your mind a little bit here.
Oh, man. Dude, I don't know if I might get shit for this, but, like, I've always been a really big Kanye West fan.
I am, too.
Like,
I like him better as a producer, like when he did Man on the Moon with Kid Cudi.
Mm-hmm.
But what was his Red album?
My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy.
That is my one of my favorite albums of all time.
I think it's in my top 10, too. And, like, I'd say this at the time. My single favorite track of the entire 2000s was Runaway. That is a masterful song.
That's, what about with the Seth Rogen movie? Was it the Night Before? When have you seen it?
No, I never saw it. Like, I'm far behind on Rogen.
Okay, so they had the keyboard. They had this giant keyboard on the floor and the three boys, and they play, they do a cover of that.
That's funny.
Oh, wow.
It was a hell of a, I was like, yes, because, you know, I love that album. And that was, yeah, that's probably the greatest song on that album, no doubt.
Yeah, to me, that's the centerpiece of the album. But yeah, I mean, the thing with Kanye is, I mean, I've told people this, is like, look, I have long believed in the principle of separate the art from the artist. There's a lot of people whose work I admire,
mm-hmm,
that there's a lot of elements, yeah, of their personality I really don't care for. And, like,
right,
for, yeah, example, I'll pick a guy, one of my favorites, Lou Reed. I love his music. But the guy himself, from everything I've heard, the guy was a total dick.
Yeah. Thanks.
Back to the original talk on music, Bowie-esque.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, like, I've been thinking a lot these past few years about the idea of genre.
Mm-hmm.
And specifically how I think genre is dead. And maybe it, like, maybe in the terms of, like, strict boundaries, it should be.
Mm-hmm. I like how when we can't classify what it is, we just call it Americana.
No labels.
Like, there was, like, I had a moment with Beyonce back when Lemonade dropped in 2016. I was not a fan before that, but those were dark times. Bowie just died. Prince had just died. I was looking for something. Ooh. I was looking for something, and this Lemonade album dropped. And I saw on there where she did a song with Jack White. And I'm like, don't hurt yourself. I'm like, this is Beyonce with Jack White. and the fucking drum sample is John Bonham from When the Levee Breaks. Like, this is beautiful. I love it. I don't get how all this goes together, but it fucking works.
Yeah.
And maybe who gives a fuck about genre? Who cares?
You want to talk about
it's great,
genres,
it's great.
You want to talk about genres
altogether? Holy shit.
I love bluegrass music too, so I was deep in the YouTube watching bluegrass musicians, and one of my favorite ones is Ricky Skaggs,
mm-hmm.
and I saw one where he did a song with Jack White. You know, so it was like Jack White and Ricky Skaggs, like Never Would Have Thought, and they went hard. It was damn good, too. I can't remember the name of the song, but like they collaborated together, too.
The only thing I'll say, I guess to argue that point about genre, is just back to Jack White, and like I love everything that he does at Third Man Records, is like the revitalization of Motown.
Mm-hmm.
And like, the representation of that, and like, we do need to know that this is Detroit, this is Motown, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But that would be it. If anything else, I would love to walk away from it, cause like it's crazy. Like when you go to talk about music and you're trying to share something new with somebody, and especially if you know what they like, is how can I pander this to you to make you feel like you should check it out?
Mm-hmm.
I know you like folk, so it's folk punk. Or did you just yeah. gonna say some weird shit like that? You know? So at this point, it's like, I do believe, like, your R&B, rap, your big genres should exist. But when we start subclassifying and then classifying within the subgenres, it's like we are wearing ourselves out.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like with the, I know, was it like in the hardcore scene? It's like, oh, this is metalcore, this is grindcore,
yeah.
this is this core, this
post-core,
is
post-core, yeah. This is screamo. This is
mm-hmm. it,
there's. They have this or pop punk or pop punk core or, you know, they same thing. It's they have this. I think some of it too is with now the way that music is distributed, and then people go through and look for, you know, you go through if you get on a channel and you, what do you feel like listening to? Well, what genre do you want to listen to? So they make sure they tag themselves
to
and all these different ones to get more exposure.
And then you have playlists dedicated to the genre. You know?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And they kind of blend in together because it's like, oh, if you like this one, you may like this one because they also have this, you know.
Well, Justin, thank you so much. First time on the show.
You're welcome. It was an honor to be here.
Johnny, back again. And fired. You're fired.
I'm fired. I knew that was coming.
You're doing a great job, but you're fired.
Okay. Well, you could just stay with him then.
We have your replacement. Great guy. The best in the biz. News and notes. Thank you so much for listening to Porch Talk. If you haven't done so already, I would ask you to rate and review the show on whatever podcast app it is that you're listening to on. Connect with us on social media. We have a website, www.porch-talk.net. You can catch up on things gone by, things to come. I'm going to walk it down out the door here with Early James, High Horse. See y'all. Peace out.
Well, I kinda sorta wish that I could keep clean, and the kinda sorta way that I used to be. It's a childlike belief in time's been the faith all along, and that's the view from this high horse I'm on. A fever dream, it seems, of just passing the time. Too much nicotine, caffeine, and wine. With my milk mustache shaved, things I once craved make me own. And that's the view from this high horse I'm on. And I can't remember the last time that I climbed a tree. Now when I am high, there ain't much that I wanna see.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.